This is the smell of the leftover tuna fish sandwich you left in your lunchbox over the weekend in a Wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, Wimpy, Wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a Hefty Ultra Strong trash bag.
Hefty, Hefty, Hefty!
Ah, smell the difference? Hefty Ultra Strong has Arm & Hammer with continuous odor control, so no matter what's inside your trash, you can stay one step ahead of stinky. And for bigger jobs, try the superior strength of Hefty Large Black Bags.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 429 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Our very special guest this week is Emily Hauser. She is an expert in human rights. She's based in Washington, D.C. We talked to her about the January 6th hearings in the USA and, of course, related to what happened in Colombia regarding the Paro Nacional in 2019 and 2021. And she brings in her expertise on the historic Colombian figure, or the historic neo-Granadine figure of Antonio Nariño, who, of course, was indeed very much invested into human rights. And it's just a fascinating conversation about a period of history and a character and an individual that I know so little about. I think he was three times imprisoned. Anyway, I'm going to leave it to Emily because she's the expert. So we'll go over now to news with Emily Hart, and then we'll be back with Emily Hauser talking about Antonio Nariño, talking about civil unrest, Colombian history, linking it to Les Miserables, and all sorts of curious anecdotes, but a fantastic conversation that I know you'll enjoy. So don't go away, and thank you for listening. And of course, a couple of word messages from our sponsors. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by latinnews.com. That's Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all this week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And also, this episode is brought to you by BNB Colombia Tours, expert in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com, complete the free itinerary form, and tell them that Columbia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So check out latinnews.com and BNB Colombia Tours. Thank you again, and don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is an election special of your weekly news update for the week of Monday, June 20th, 2022. Gustavo Petro is to be Colombia's first ever left-wing president, elected with 50% of the vote at the runoff election on Sunday, ushering in a new era of politics for the country. He won by a 3% margin amid the highest turnout in more than two decades at nearly 60%. We are writing history, a new history for Colombia. What is coming is real change, said Petro in his first address as president-elect. He pledged to govern with dialogue and unity, including with those who ran and voted against him, in order to reach peace and progress, and to become, in his words, one Colombia, even with all our diversity. Petro, now 62, joined urban guerrilla group M19 in the 1980s, then demobilized and has spent three decades in political opposition. He had run for president twice before this year, reaching the runoff in 2018 and serving as leader of the opposition since then. He made a name for himself in politics through anti-corruption work, opening a national debate about the links between the country's political elite and right-wing paramilitaries, war crimes, and death squads. Having also been mayor of Bogota, he has now won his third attempt at the presidency, ousting Colombia's political establishment in the process. Petro campaigned on a ticket of transformation, promising a structural reform of Colombia's systems and institutions to include the excluded. He said he would make universities free and promised energy transition, an end to Colombia's oil exploration and fracking projects in order to mitigate climate change. He also proposed land reform, raising taxes on the wealthiest and supporting routes to land ownership for small tenant farmers and local cooperatives. Francia Márquez will be his vice president, an award-winning environmentalist and the first ever Afro-Colombian woman to fill the role. She has formed a key part of Petro's campaign and his popularity, promoting feminism, racial equality, and environmentalism. She has made direct appeals to los nadie, the nobodies, those marginalized and excluded by politics and neglected by the state. Petro and Márquez won against populist wildcard and eccentric multimillionaire Rodolfo Hernández, who ran on an anti-corruption ticket, gaining 47% of the vote. Despite fears of a contested election, Hernández immediately accepted the results. There were parties in the streets of Cali and Bogota last night, but not everyone feels optimistic about Petro's coming mandate. Some feel he is too radical and will bring instability. Petro, meanwhile, has pledged to turn Colombia into a world power for life, though his first challenge will be uniting a deeply divided country. Colombia remains polarized, and he faces staunch opposition both within Congress and among Colombian citizens. He is the leader of the biggest party in Congress, known as the Historic Pact, but remains well short of a majority. His first task will be to forge the alliances needed to fulfill the big promises he has made to the electorate and to ensure governability. Petro joins a wave of left-wing leaders who have come to power in Latin America since the start of this decade, many of whom have already taken to Twitter to congratulate him, including the leaders of Mexico, Chile, and Peru. Gustavo Petro will be inaugurated as the 42nd president of Colombia on August the 7th of this year. That was your update for this week. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next Monday.
And we're back. This is episode 429 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall, as you well know. My very special guest is, now you'll have to forgive me, Emily, but Emily Hauser. Emily Hauser, she's in Washington, D.C. She holds a master's in human rights from up there. And, well, I don't know. I would call her a Venezuela or perhaps Nueva Granada historian, because her knowledge of Antonio Nariño is second to none. And in fact, over more than a year, I get peppered with tweets about Antonio Nariño, and I feel somewhat out of my depth because I don't know that much about it, because my knowledge of Colombian history is incredibly contemporary. It goes back a bit, but contemporary. So we're going to discuss sort of Colombian, Venezuelan history and so on. But she's in Washington, D.C., and we are recording this ahead of time. And I know right now that the January 6th hearings are taking place up there. How does it feel to be in that position?
Oh, we are rather tense at the moment, as this definitely for us crossed the line as not a peaceful demonstration, but a violent act to force a particular viewpoint on the country. I was at home in New Jersey at the time, where I'm originally from. And as someone that knows and loves the capital very well, I had a mixed sense of indignation mixed with heartbreak about how now people are resorting to violence to solve their differences.
That's a That's a very Colombian thing. It's resorting to violence for the differences, and in Venezuela too. We're talking before anything is actually declared, but it does seem that it was a totally orchestrated event. It wasn't just on the spur of the moment, a few sort of rogue elements getting in. I mean, how do you feel?
There rather was. For years, we've had an escalation, rather like a volcano. I don't want to blame one individual in particular, but it felt like we were brewing and brewing under the surface. And there were many different factors at play that culminated into this volcanic explosion that we saw on January 6th. Mm. But deeper than that, there was elements of polarizing rhetoric and differing the others and different groups as, unquote, threats. And that resulted in the violence we saw.
And I mean, I think here, if we relate it to here, I always feel that the tension builds. There is, let's say, there are demonstrations. The government's response is always, that if the government responds appropriately, this can deflate the tension. In Colombia, when we had 2019 and 2021, the sort of nationwide and so on, which were then, when we look at Cali, which were then sort of usurped by, in the southern city of Cali, by, I would say, organized crime, whereas in Bogota, it was still a political thing. But the government didn't respond appropriately and didn't dispel the tension. Did that one act, that one day, did it deflate tension afterwards, or is it now reached a plateau where we're still waiting for answers?
We are definitely in a plateau right now, and it's a rather difficult situation because people by nature react. So one act of violence will create a reaction or instinct on the other half, which will result in more force. So we're trying to find a way to diffuse the situation and address the root causes of this problem.
Because it was an interesting situation. And then we'll close this chapter here. But it was an interesting situation when we see this happening, with those of us sitting here in Colombia, which are, we're used to sort of uncertainty and instability. And I mean, I live very close to part of a national university, which is a hotbed for, let's say, purist leftist thought, I would say, is the most polite way of putting it. Purist leftist thought. And they're always, when they don't like something, they're out there throwing bricks, and then there's tear gas thrown. And so, it's not unusual to see. But then we're getting the articles in the press, and then, of course, the memes on social media. Look what's happening in Washington. I mean, the comparison was obviously made, wasn't it? I mean, suddenly the DC is in, how to best put this, DC is resembling more of a developing part of the developing world with an immature political situation. And Colombia looks, stable.
One thing that really spoke to me, you don't mind me bringing in a little bit of France, right? I am a big fan of Les Misérables, both the musical and the book. And I did my master's thesis on the human rights violations that led to the June Rebellion and how the June Rebellion, although relatively forgotten, influences democracy movements in Belarus and Venezuela through Les Mis. Mm. And the real-life leader of the rebellion had a very strong code of honor on the barricades. Some people believed it was excessive because even something as ripping a pamphlet he saw as an act of escalation. But one of his reasons was he believed agitators and escalators creating tension would result in the other side justifying a violent response, which that really spoke to me as very interesting. Yeah. I'm not saying it's the case with anything, but I definitely made me think more about the importance of peaceful protesting and how one little act could result in such a terrible culmination.
But we always think of the one act because it becomes the historic point about which all the narratives are written. You say that tearing up of the pamphlet here in Colombia, for example, when it was the sort of Creole business owner called Llorente who was asked by the Spanish empire, let's say, Spanish leaders, in to lend his vase for the arrival of someone else, because it was a vase that was very beautiful and they wanted to decorate somewhere or something for it. And of course, Llorente said no and threw it on the ground and smashed it. And that's sort of seen as a kickoff. And you're like, well, you know, the breaking of a vase, but it's the spark to an already, you know, primed tinderbox. And that, so therefore your pamphlet as well is the spark. Of course, when you look at France, I mean, everyone says, oh, it's because of the hunger beforehand. No, it's a pile up of the situation. And there's a political, psychological reality of what's going on in a country. I mean, these things don't happen like that.
Exactly. A wise political leader must listen to the concerns of his people, and information that leads to people committing violent acts against their fellow citizens or against their fellow humans really should absolutely be diffused. And it shows the importance of a dialogue too between sides. That dialogue doesn't happen, that's when very hateful and harmful narratives happen against the other.
Of course, now back to Colombia, there was no dialogue. Our president did not address any of the situations in the strikes in 2021. He was saved in 2019. There was the Gran Mesa, the Diálogo y Conversación, which was, again, a way of stalling, a way of doing nothing. And then the pandemic came in so that Mesa could be lifted. So, but let's talk about this. You got heavily involved in transcribing the Declaration of Rights. All right. Tell us about this. What went through your mind? You said, I'm going to transcribe this, because I know at one point you were going to you were going to broadcast them on a government building?
This is an interesting story. So it was 2020, and it was the beginning of lockdown, and I recently was in the process of wrapping up my master's capstone, and I thought it'd be a fascinating idea to start transcribing the Declaration of Rights into as many languages as I could find it, to compare the way rights are translated across languages. Most of these were Romance languages, but I also mixed in a few dramatic ones and a few Slavic ones. I'm really curious if there's any countries today where the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen might still be banned. It sounds like this is the case, but I'm not going to state before I have some proof. And I ended up translating the document myself into English to give a modern and contemporary translation of this document. And within that, I remember the story of Antonio Nariño, who got arrested and really subjugated to the worst brutality just for translating the same document I transcribed. And that really shined a new light on the whole situation. And when the crisis in Ukraine started, my building faces the Senate. And there were a few empty apartments by me. And a friend and I thought it'd be a really good show of solidarity to enlarge the Declaration of Rights in Ukrainian and paste it on all of the windows. However, we cannot get the fonts big enough, no matter how often we played with the printer.
That's a lot of paper as well, I think, if you had to play with that. But so this gave you the insight into Antonio Nariño. And now I'll talk for myself. I don't know a lot about Antonio Nariño. Give us a little bit of background. You know, who was he? Let's listen to the era and so on. Let's hear from your profound historical knowledge on this fact.
Absolutely. So he was born April 9th, 1765, in Bogota, Colombia, to a rather well-to-do family. He, as a child, was very sick and very fragile, so his parents educated him at home in his wonderful library of over 2,000 books. Nariño devoured books. He read Las Casas, he read Rousseau, Montesquieu, Voltaire, and he also read a lot of the scholastics, such as Thomas Aquinas and Saint Augustine. And he had this thirst for knowledge, a desire to learn as much as he could. He hosted little intellectual gatherings with his friends where they would discuss democracy and the free press, and they were filled with idealism. Mm. And then one day, he was in his late 20s, around 29 years old. He thought it'd be a great idea to translate the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen, as he got the text of the document from a friend of his who was a trusted official. So when Nariño translated it, he heard, you know, this document might actually get you in trouble, so maybe you should have translated it. And he thought, I don't think so. There's nothing really controversial here. The free press, natural law, Thomas Aquinas says the same thing, and we all read Thomas Aquinas. And he did first safekeeping, burn the translations he had, because he had six children and a young wife, and he didn't want harm to come to them. However, somebody turned him in, and as he was facing the royal tribunal, they interrogated him for, you're trying to bring the French Revolution to the colonies, and you're trying to overthrow the system. And Nariño insisted, I was just translating a document so people could understand and have a dialogue about human rights. I'm not trying to bring the French Revolution to America. That's not my goal. However, they then laid other charges on him that were not true, such as one was embezzlement and a couple others, just random things they were pulling out of the book, and none of it was proven. So he was arrested and sent to 10 years of exile in Africa. However, he escaped when the ship docked in Spain. The details here are a little blurry. I'm not sure how he was able to escape, because there's a lot of legends surrounding it. But he escaped and in Spain tried getting the king's approval, but he was sensing people didn't like what he was doing and they didn't like what he stood for. So he fled to France and fled to England. And finally, he returned to Colombia to see his wife and children. He was in disguise, but he was captured and turned in. His lawyer wrote an excellent defense of Nariño, Jose Antonio Ricaurte. And he mentioned how none of the words of the Declaration of Rights are prohibited because all of it is either found in the Bible or it's found in Aquinas. And he went detail by detail. At the time, Nariño was having anxiety attacks and some other illnesses, such as beginning tuberculosis, which was making it hard for him to defend himself. And they kept saying that he said, confess the things that he didn't confess to. So Ricaurte wrote this excellent defense, and then Ricaurte was arrested and tragically died in the dungeons. Nariño was getting sicker and sicker, and this is where his wife, Magdalena Nariño, really takes center stage. She writes to the king, writes to the queen, writes to every official possible saying, you are violating the Spanish principles you say you stand for, of justice. He is dying of tuberculosis. He has a heart condition. You're denying him medical treatment. They ignored her, but finally the archbishop listened to her. They went into the dungeons, and Nariño was indeed almost near death at this point. They got him out, and he recovered. And he recovered enough to, he tried living a peaceful, quiet life with his books, but as winds of rebellion started brewing again, the government arrested him for just for having different opinions. They had no proof. They had no evidence. They just abducted him one day and tossed him in a dungeon in Cartagena. His son tried accompanying him, and his son as well was arrested and tossed into that dungeon. And there were some rather graphic details I saw in the accounts of what happened to the both of them. It made me very indignant. He was released when another rebellion came. So there's a lot of twists and turns in his life. And he started a little periodical called The Bagatella, where he advocated a lot for indigenous rights and human rights for all people.
But so, I mean, this guy, Nariño, he, you know, despite translating something that, or that the language is in the Bible and he's not making anything. He is seen as subversive. He is obviously, and it's very easy. I think it's easier then than now just to say you think differently and throw you in jail. Although this practice has been proven to occur again and again and again. But why? I mean, was he in Cartagena living there when he was thrown in the dungeons there, or did they move him up to Cartagena?
They moved him. He was in Bogota.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he was abducted and then arbitrarily detained.
Uh-huh.
He did not know the reasons for his detention. He was asking, they refused to give it to him. And they made him get on a horse that was very ill. And Nariño mentioned, this is cruelty to the horse. This is awful. And of course, it's cruelty to my rights to abduct me without a cause. They sent him from Bogota to Cartagena and then subjugated him to a dungeon that was meant for people who were sentenced to die.
Okay, so like an oubliette kind of thing. It's like you die in there. So that would have meant they did the week or several week long, because it was going down from Bogota to Onda on a lame horse, and then he would have done the Magdalena River because that was the way up. Which is when you read any diary or from the period or later, is what was one of the most arduous journeys. So I can only imagine if you were going like as in a, you know, for on if you were doing this journey for pleasure, it was arduous. If you were doing this person as someone who was abducted, it would be, I mean, I just think awful. Even awful. So, I mean, he represents something, and Ricaurte obviously as well. Ricaurte represents something. But so you said that Ricaurte died in prison in Bogota, his lawyer?
He was also transferred to Cartagena and died there.
Okay. So that would have been it wasn't the Castillo San Felipe at that time, but it probably would have been around the Bóvedas in Cartagena.
I believe it was.
Yeah. So that would have been, I'm sure there's a plaque or something up there, but that would have been around the Bóvedas. So, I mean, you know, his writings, human rights, and we put it into context, these are important things. He wasn't doing anything really by today's standards out of control. But obviously back in the day, it's all about power, it's all about authority, and so on. But so, I mean, let's put it into context. It's because you see lots of, in your Twitter feed and so on, you see lots of correlations and parallels between what Nariño is writing and what's going on today in this part of the world.
Absolutely. There's a new resurgence, especially in Venezuela, where I've done a lot of human rights research about, of this idea of a strongman ruler. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to crack down on speech that they find threatening to them and just toss people in jail, not in the dungeons nowadays, but in other tools like the Helen Condé, and try to isolate them and cut off their speech. Mm. I believe it's a large part a reaction against democratic movements, such as, well, this is over in Europe, but Belarus, the dictator banned Les Miserables. And he banned the song, Do You Hear the People Sing? Because he said, these are bringing in dangerous ideas from France and the United States, introducing democracy. The dictators are beginning to tighten their grip. And rather like the Holy Alliance, which Spain was a part of at the time, mm-hmm. the Holy Alliance sought to have dictators, well, kings, back each other up and really crack down on any kind of dissent. Uh-huh. It was a reaction against the excesses of the French Revolution, which terrified many of the absolute monarchs. But even before the excesses, they were becoming nervous. There's a threat to our power. Mm-hmm. So instead of liberalizing and democratizing to ease the storm, they consolidated power, and you're translating a document, you're arrested. You're reading Voltaire, you're arrested. And I definitely see that happening today in many authoritarian regimes. That sort of Holy Alliance.
I love it. We somehow here on the Columbia Calling podcast, we've managed to bring in Lukashenko. I think it's the first time he's ever been mentioned in 429 episodes. But so, I mean, this is interesting, definitely. And you talk about obviously people in Venezuela, and you've done a lot of research on this and political prisoners. I don't imagine the prisons in Venezuela being too dissimilar to dungeons back in the day.
It's true.
I think they're probably pretty awful because, you know, Maduro is and his cronies, they just want these people to expire. And you talked about the helicoid and stuff, that building.
It is.
It's such a fascinating story, you know, that building put in the area of Caracas is kind of like a regeneration project and now being used to hold political prisoners, this futuristic building there. And so, but tell us about your research into Venezuela and so on, because we do have to talk about our neighboring country. And then we have to sort of mention that by the time this comes out, there'll be a new president elect in Colombia. But at the moment, both Rodolfo Hernandez and Gustavo Petro have talked about, you know, reestablishing relations with Venezuela. And for me personally, you know, it's your neighboring country. It's a hard decision to make, but we're in hard times too. So, I mean, not to simplify, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. Human rights, you've studied, and I think you campaign on behalf of some of these prisoners.
I do. It started when I was on a Hill internship, Capitol Hill, and I was writing a project on the crisis of Venezuela. And this involved me reading a lot of Leopoldo Lopez's memoirs that he wrote in the prison cell that his sister smuggled out. And I read some other accounts of torture and brutality that, if I didn't have context, I felt as though I could just copy and paste these stories to Antonio Nariño or to any political prisoner from that era. One of my cases that I'm working on now is Roland Carreño. His sister is on Twitter and raising the alarm for them, depriving him of medical treatment and depriving him of his religious rights, because as Venezuela is a Catholic country, they believe they need to see a priest for confession, and they're denying their political prisoners that. Huh. So I wrote to the Pope as one of my contexts to raise awareness, and several NGOs and nonprofits about this situation.
Did the Pope respond?
He did not.
Ah, okay. Well, he gets a lot of letters, I think.
He probably does.
So tell us, what do you think then, you're heavily involved in this. How do you feel about the Colombian move to reopen, let's say, sort of conversations at the very least to begin with, and then it will move into trade and passage of people? How do you feel this with Colombia, Venezuela?
I'm a bit cautious, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I definitely see an important need for dialogue and an important need for helping the refugee crisis, which I know Colombia has already been doing tremendously. Mm. What gets me weary is this may entrench the dictator's power further, since the dictators are relying on outside support. And one of the things that kept Maduro in power is the people in his upper ranks were rather comfortable and happy with what was going on. And he was connected to a network of dictators. I feel there's a need for democracies to come together to show democracies can do things. Democracies give you the free press and free religion, and you can express yourself without fear of being tossed in the dungeon. So, or the helical aid. But I'm definitely rather cautious as to what level of reopening up there will be when it comes to the government itself of Venezuela.
A few episodes ago, we discussed it, you know, about we had the host of the State of Venezuela podcast on. And of course, you know, he comes from a political standpoint, which, you know, one understands, and political positions are to be accepted and respected and so on. And he had a lot of great points. And I remember all this thing. And we mentioned the Russian involvement in Venezuela. We mentioned, and I think there's Chinese involvement as well, the Russian oil and Russian this and that. I don't know if I'm pushing the limits of yours and my knowledge, but surely the war with Ukraine must be affecting Russia's, let's say, foreign policy on places like Latin America, South America. Could this weaken Maduro then, if Russia sort of, let's say, turns its back a bit on Venezuela?
Possibly. There seems to be a lot of discontent, understandably, from the people. And there is a Simon Bolivar quote, which says, I'm going to paraphrase because he wrote it in a very long part of the letter of Jamaica, how we have a duty to stand for people who are fighting for their rights. And in that case, I hope that the members of the democratic world will come and get around again in solidarity for the Venezuelan people, the way we are showing solidarity for the people of Ukraine, since I definitely do believe this is a global situation of imperialism versus democracy. And not to say it's identical to what Nariño and Sucre saw with the Holy Alliance, because obviously different times and different contexts, but there definitely is a very solid parallel there that I believe we could learn from.
This is really so interesting that we can take, and I know that history repeats itself, and that this is oft said, but this is, a history when we talk about Nariño, which is not overly known, and Rica Orte less so, unless you're Colombian and you've had to study a little bit of it in school, although I do believe that history and geography are kind of being cut from public education here. So, therefore, aren't we condemned to repeat the errors of the past if we don't learn about them? But people will talk about Nariño, and people here will talk about Rica Orte, but beyond these frontiers, it's really unknown. And now you are being able to link it not only to Les Misérables, but also to Ukraine, Russia, Belarus. That's pretty cool. I mean, I have to say, that's to be able to do this, where are we going to be able to read some of this stuff? Because you must be writing it down.
Le droit et la liberté on WordPress.
Okay, le droit et liberté.
I have my URL in French, because I take a lot of my inspiration from everything French, and that's where I publish a lot of my formal research. I also write occasionally smaller articles for Medium and Odyssey. And for my human rights translations, I translated Defensa de Nariño, and that will be on my blog, Human Rights in Many Languages. That probably was one of my most difficult translations, because even though I understood what was happening, the level of detail was so horrific while translating it. I just felt like, I'm so glad that Nariño was able to get out of that prison, but all my solidarity with the political prisoners today going through that situation.
When you talk about the level of detail, we're talking about torture?
There were some graphic depictions of the aftermath of torture, which stayed with him for the rest of his life, since when he was two imprisonments later, he was addressing members of Congress, the Congress of Cúcuta, and he felt that some of the delegates were not taking seriously the concern of Spanish reconquest and the brutality the Spanish committed. And he actually revealed several of his scars to members of Congress.
This was all incurred in the third prison sentence.
Yes. He was, after he escaped, he was freed from the second prison sentence to Cartagena and La Bagatella. People were very dissatisfied with the leadership that was trying to cater to Spain, but trying to stay middle of the road of Jorge Luzano. There were massive protests, and in the mixture, Nariño became president. But he had to manage a lot of Colombia. Instead of unifying and fighting Spain, decided to fight each other. So each state wanted to be its own country. They all fought each other, allowing for the Spanish to come back and rather brutally reclaim them. The entire population of Venezuela in particular endured some of the worst fronts, as two-thirds of the population, it's estimated, were massacred. There's no real number.
No. Because we would, yeah, two-thirds of the population massacred. How many have left the country now? I mean, it's, is it a sixth or something? I mean, it's got to be, the figures have got to be, let's say, comparable.
it's very comparable.
Yeah. That's bizarre, isn't it? How these things come around. Really, tell us that now, little side anecdote, because we've talked about this stuff. I know that you, you went and heard one of my most favorite, and anyone who knows me will know that to be somewhat sarcastic, one of my most favorite Colombian politicians speak in Colombia, the vice president, Marta Lucia Ramirez. You heard her speak in Washington, and I get that we can't talk too much about it, but what was the vibe you got from her?
Well, it was a vibe that, let's just say, I would not want, I faced many disagreements with her.
Did she, was she talking about the, because she always sort of, her, one of her big, well, it's a government policy to always talk of anyone who protests is obviously, you know, either a Venezuelan troublemaker. They've tried to tie stuff to Russia. Did she talk about that stuff?
She didn't. She used a lot of very eloquent words, but I had difficulty finding the message of the speech.
So it was kind of a performance, an act, you think? Yeah. She doesn't, you know, you don't feel convinced by her. It feels like, yeah, and for, you know, we have to talk. She's the first female vice president in Colombia. This is all fantastic, but there's so many questions surrounding her authority. Obviously, there's the questions surrounding her husband and his influences. You don't have to mention, Ali will talk about this, but influences of Memo Fantasma, the investor in the building. Her brother was found guilty. I think it was transporting heroin to the US. Yeah, it's there. It's in the Southern District of New York. And she talks about it as a family tragedy and so on. And then she talks about the fact that her husband would never have known Memo Fantasma, but he was a major investor in these things. And so you sort of wonder how, I don't know how someone could get up on stage and make, you know, and talk about certain things when you've got so many question marks. But then that's politics here, and then that's politics in general. I mean, you know, you had President Trump with, and there was a, you know, there's a few question marks there as well about business practices and family relationships and so on. But I mean, I think it's really interesting that you didn't get, I think it's safe to say that the best feeling from her. You have not compromised yourself in any way, shape, or form there, Emily. What have you had any other contact with, let's say, a Colombian or Venezuela activists in recent times to, you know, to further the cause of human rights?
I did meet Juan Guaido very briefly, but very far away. That was actually right before the pandemic, so I don't know if it counts, how recent it counts, but he was giving a speech at the Organization of American States.
Oh, yeah.
And it was completely in Spanish, but I spoke to a lot of the Venezuelans who were there and heard many of their stories, and it was heartbreaking, stuff that people get arrested for or have to flee for. And I met a few Venezuelan refugees when I was writing about a protest for Ukraine that was happening in Washington, D.C. So I was discussing the issues with several of the participants and planning an article on how Ukrainians are failing right now. And in the audience were several Venezuelans who saw it as we are in the same fight for democracy against autocracy. And I have noticed Leopoldo Lopez, so other Venezuelans are now saying the same message. It's one fight against dictatorships.
So, I mean, briefly and from distance, Juan Guaido, what was he like?
He was very animated at the time as a speaker. It was a very cold February night, but he had a lot of passion when he was on stage.
Yeah, because his, I mean, you know, just like Leopoldo López and then, you know, Juan Guaido's star is very much in decline. And obviously with the announcements by both political candidates, presidential candidates, Juan Guaido is officially recognized by Colombia and the U.S., but what happens next? I mean, where does he go from here? I mean, where is the money coming from as well to fund, you know, say his parallel government?
It's definitely a rather difficult situation since it feels like a stalemate. We all want something to happen. We're like, okay, Maduro, time to go backstage. New leader time, peaceful transition of power. Peaceful transition of power is fundamental and very important. Mm-hmm. But Maduro won't budge. I was going to make a comparison with Maduro and Aymaric, but that might be a little bit of a stretch, but he's not going to budge. And it just seems like the whole country is on pause right now.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously, there are other issues taking place across the world, the Ukraine and so on. So Venezuela has fallen very much off the front page. And, you know, even Colombia, for everything that's going on, it's becoming more difficult to publish long form about, rather than just, you know, a news piece reporting on what's going on rapidly, 600 words, not being able to explain a situation. But I mean, Venezuela, we're next door and we don't really know what's going on. I mean, aside from what is being told by the millions of refugees, but they are telling us about what, you know, what happened when they left, or the new ones will tell us about what's going on. What is going on? I guess in conflict resolution, because it's a hurtful stalemate, isn't it? As you said, stalemate, harmful stalemate. Because nobody's winning and nobody's really benefiting aside from, I guess, Maduro and his cronies. Because beyond that, it's got to be, it's just an existence, isn't it?
There's a lot of disconnect, I noticed, within the Americas. Both between the United States and Latin America, there's a huge disconnect. And as somebody who grew up loving geography and devoured geography books and politics books the way Nariño did, it hurts me when I see people dismiss the region. And there's also a disconnect in Latin America within each, from themselves almost, like with from country to country. Because when I mentioned the massacres that occurred in Venezuela during the War for Independence, I had several commentators, they were nice, they were not the trolls, saying, wow, I had no idea. Is this why the Patriots were so angry at us loyalists? I was like, it definitely was. Besides, war is extremely ugly. There's a large disconnect, and this is what happened in Venezuela versus what happened in the rest of the continent. Then when you get to the south with San Martin, it's a different story altogether.
Yeah. We're going to San Martin, Bernardo O'Higgins, and beyond. We're not going to complicate life.
That's another story.
That's another time. Well, I think, you know, I've learned about Nariño and his history from you here, just chatting in, you know, 40 short minutes. I think you've got a great deal to share. So will you please tell us again your website so people can look them up and drive some traffic and learn some more?
Absolutely. So les droits, so it's a French word for rights, les droits et la liberté is the French translation of rights and liberty.
WordPress.com. So we will put that up on the Facebook page. I don't promise thousands of readers and stuff, but maybe, you know, if we get some more messages out there that these are things that are repetitive. I mean,
that is
by your dialogue today has shown us that these things are kind of cyclical.
Absolutely. You know? I find the rest of Nariño's life, which very brief, to be as fascinating as well. After his presidency, he was again arrested by royalist troops in the south. But when that happened, he refused to reveal his identity. And a lot of the royalists were relying on just their wanting to stay loyal to the king. And he went out on the balcony and proclaimed before an angry mob that I respect your views, I respect your opinions, but if you want to imprison me, here I am. Like that bravery, and the whole mob was silent when they found out that actually was Antonio Nariño. And he was supposed to be executed, but either due to a intentional misspelling by the commander of the Spanish army, or perhaps a moment of charity where he really did want to help Nariño. Nariño was sent to Spain, to Cadiz, in a dungeon, instead of being executed. Upon his return, Bolívar made him vice president, but there was a lot of political infighting because Nariño was someone that was very open about his ideals and his beliefs. He stood true to, I want indigenous land returned, I want human rights for all. And he ran another periodical where he was extremely outspoken, which of course caused political controversy. He eventually retired and had several illnesses, tuberculosis, heart issues, poor vision, and difficulty walking. But during his death at Villa de Leyva, he had a choir of monks singing to him. I was trying to find some of the songs on YouTube. I found It's Yami, and there's a few others I'm still trying to track down. And he mentioned the importance of showing peace and love even to those who abuse them so badly, because in the end, even they could change and come around to defend human rights. And I thought that was incredible, where he wrote to Bolivar saying, what use is our triumphs if peace doesn't secure what our rights are?
He's a compassionate person.
He was. And that really touched me after all he went through, just that love he had. And his last words were, I've loved my country, even though everyone has tried to give me chains. With all my heart, I will continue fighting against tyrants, but showing that love to others.
Really interesting. I didn't now southern. Before we finish it, southern Colombia, we're looking at Pasto.
Yeah,
and they were royalist.
Very much.
Wow. You mean you'd think sort of like a more indigenous Andean region might be more sort of, let's say, Republican, but no, they were royalist.
There was an extremely complex hold on them, which involved a lot of the Spanish elites not wanting to surrender, mixed with their own historiography they created.
Not dissimilar to today. Not Spanish elites, but descendants of Spanish elites, let's just say. Not dissimilar today. Emily, thank you so much for sharing all of this information so unselfishly with us. You speak so well and so clearly about it. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the Columbia Calling podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm a big listener, and it feels an honor to be on this podcast.
Well, as I say often, flattery will get you everywhere. We've been talking to Emily Hauscher. This has been episode 429. Thank you again to Emily. We'll put her website up on the Facebook page. And of course, now we'll go over to some words from our sponsors. But again, thank you for listening, everyone. This episode was brought to you by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean. Since 1967, their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And also, our other sponsor is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com, complete the free itinerary form, and tell them that Columbia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So that's bnbcolombia.com and, of course, latinnews.com. Thank you for everyone for listening. That's us. Farewell. And, of course, check back next week. Bye-bye. La canoa de Barca.
tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.